Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for home theater geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded June 20th, 2011, episode 69. It's all in your head. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies streamed to your PC, Mac, or TV instantly. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with ultimateavmag.com and hometheater.com. This week's guest geek is Tile Hertzens, the founder of Headroom and the current editor of innerfidelity.com, one of my company's latest websites. Hey, Tile, welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. Good to see you live and, well, over the interwebs.
Live and sort of in color. Those who are tuned into the chat room at irc.twit.tv or watching the live stream at live.twit.tv can post questions for Tile here in the chat room, and I will be monitoring that and passing along as many as I can. Now, today's topic is headphones.
Oh, I wasn't prepared for that.
Oh, doggone it. Now, I was surprised to hear when, Tile, when you and I were talking before the show, how much of a hobby, of a geek hobby, headphones are. How does that work?
You know, that is a pretty amazing thing. I remember when I first started seeing forums pop up, the Headwise forum way back in the day, and seeing that a hobby was coming of it. I really didn't expect a hobby to come of it. And slowly but surely, there was a big following of enthusiasts of headphone geeks on the interweb, and they started building their own headphone amplifiers and talking to each other about headphones and which ones were good and which ones weren't and so on and so forth. And the hobby really took off, though, when they started doing meets. And so what happens is on HeadFi, head-fi.org, that's the big headphone geek board. And there's a section for meets, and people just say, hey, let's get together this weekend and bring our headphone gear together and so on and so forth. And they come together, started in people's homes, and then pretty soon, I think the Boston group was one of the first ones to start doing it at hotel conference rooms, and all the guys would pitch in. And after a while, there was actually an annual one for the headphone geeks that they sort of self-organized. And we were getting maybe 500 people, 600 people at the show, and dozens of vendors that were coming along. So the hobby is people talking to each other about the headphones and how they work and so on and so forth, people talking and putting together DIY gear, but also coming together in the flesh and enjoying each other's gear and music. It's something that most audiophiles can't do because they can't move the system around, but the headphone geeks, of course, come in there with their bins of stuff like a high school speech and debate team and show up and listen to music and chat and sometimes smoke cigars and drink bourbon and all that kind of stuff.
Quite, so it's great fun. Amazing.
It's a fabulous hobby, actually.
It's amazing to me because it seems so... That listening on headphones seems like such a solitary activity, and yet it fosters this large community of people to get together and talk about what they do essentially in isolation.
Yeah, I don't get it, but that's how it works. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's amazing. I think there are a bunch of extroverted introverts or vice versa. I don't know. But
yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing thing. And now there's a meet that happens virtually every weekend somewhere in the world. And they have huge meets in Asia. I mean, huge, hundreds and hundreds of people.
Man.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, you got interested in headphones at an early age, so I understand. I think you and I actually, I also listened on headphones as a junior high and high school kid on a pair of Koss headphones, and I think you had the same ones.
Exactly, the Koss Pro 4AA, a classic in a 1965 Mustang, olive green, with fluid-filled ear cups, and you'd lie in bed at night listening to Pink Floyd or whatever, and then you'd have to open the ear cups up to drain the sweat out of them every hour or two. And,
I remember that. That's amazing.
They had these knobs on the side that I don't know that they had any purpose. I think you could attach a microphone to them or something. But, yeah, they were a classic headphone, and I remember hours and hours of listening to Edgar Winter's Frankenstein on my 8-track tape with those.
Now, before getting current with your website, which we'll talk about in a minute, you sure. started a company called Headroom.
Uh-huh.
Tell us, and that's still going strong, right?
Yeah, yeah. In 1992, the story actually probably goes back earlier. I used to repair scanning electron microscopes, and would travel around the country. Yeah, would travel around the country fixing. I was west of the Mississippi. Fixing scanning electron microscopes. So I spent pretty much every day in airports going from city to city. I mean, I flew a lot. I probably averaged 3 flights a week.
Wow.
And so I spent a lot of time traveling and listening to headphones, and I got a good pair of headphones, and it sounded crappy, and then I said, well, maybe it's this, you know, sports Walkman that didn't work. I think I had a pair of Beyer DT-800s at the time. And so I tried one of the newfangled portable CD players, and that didn't make it sound any better. And I thought about it for a while, and then I sort of came to realize that, you know, it was a wimpy little power amplifier in the portable player, and I had good headphones on that probably needed more power. And so I built my own little headphone amplifier, and sure enough, it made the sound a lot better. So... So that was the beginning of the idea. And then a number of years later, when I had the opportunity to start a business, that was one of the ideas that were floating around in my head, and I ended up picking that. And Headroom in 1992 started and made the first portable headphone amplifier. We made the first balanced headphone amplifier. We had the first cross-feed circuit. Well, I shouldn't say that, actually.
What is a crossfeed circuit?
Well, imagine you're listening to two speakers, and you turn off the right speaker, and then the left speaker is heard in the left ear, but it's also heard in the right ear. Mm-hmm. And there's a time difference because the right ear is farther away, and that's called the interaural time difference. And it's that time difference that your brain uses to lateralize the sound, to localize left to right where the sound is.
To figure out where it's coming from.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. With headphones, if you turn off the right channel, it's only heard in one ear, and sure. that's not natural. Your brain really doesn't know how to process information that's only heard in one ear, because in nature, it hears everything in both ears with a short time delay. Now, there's also an EQ difference, but the time delay is the more important of the two. And so in headphones, if you listen to music, especially like old Beatles music or old jazz music where the instruments are panned hard left, hard right, one in the middle kind of thing. But if you listen to music, a lot of music on headphones, what you see is there's like a blob on the left, a blob on the right, and a blob in the middle. And at the 45-degree angles, it's missing information a lot of times. Mm. Depends a lot upon the recording. But fundamentally, without that interaural time difference cue, things want to snap left or snap to the center. And so what the crossfeed does, it's in Headroom's crossfeed in particular, it uses a two-stage active phase delay filter, linear phase delay filter, provides about 400 microseconds of delay, and mimics this crosstalk. It mixes it in at a much lower level, but it's just enough for your brain to cue on. And so it provides a better image on headphones, I claim. Now, there's a lot of people who disagree with that. Mm-hmm. There are other crossfeed circuits out there as well that are a little different. They go everything up to the Smith Realizer, I think it's called.
Yeah, that's what it's called. Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's a headphone very complex headphone processor. All of this is really about the HRTF, which is the head-related transfer function. And right. what the head-related transfer function is if you have sound in free space and stick your head in it, what does the sound look like when it's going into your ear canals? Because your body and ears will change the character of the audio.
Right, as it's diffracting around your head.
There's actually numerous effects. One is the physical size of your body creates some gain. Okay, so the frequencies that have a wavelength of about the size of your body get amplified a little bit because your body's in the way. Mm-hmm. And then the concha ridge of your ear, this sort of inner bowl, this bowl right here, amplifies sound between 2 and 6 kilohertz, thereabouts. And then there's
maybe one reason why our hearing system is most sensitive to frequencies in the 2 to 4 roughly kilohertz range.
Absolutely, you want to be able to hear a twig snap so somebody doesn't come up on you and eat you.
You also want to be able to understand what people are saying, and the consonants of speech are in that same frequency range.
Yes, the speech intelligibility, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that evolutionarily speaking, the twig snapping came before that speech.
That's probably true.
Actually, it's very interesting. The other thing that's there's more than just a time difference. They do these experiments where they cast people's ears and then they put them on a microphone right next to each other, so there's no time delay, but there's two capsules in the microphones.
Yeah.
People can still localize sound as long as the ears can move the same way their head does. Actually, the most important thing is how the cues change when your head moves.
Mm.
And then there's some effects that as the elevation changes, there's frequency shaping, and of course mm-hmm. there's a frequency shaping at all different angles around the head.
Mm-hmm.
The whole science of localization is an amazing thing.
It really is.
I don't have the book handy. There's a great book called Spatial Hearing.
Oh, he's going to go grab it. And while he does, I'm going to... Oh, here it is. Okay.
Spatial Hearing. This is a book by a guy named Jens Blauer, and he wrote the book.
There it is.
Yeah, and it's astonishing, some of the things. Very, very high frequencies up in the 12 kilohertz and above, bird tweets and things like that can't be localized and are heard in the center plane, and the different frequencies are heard arranged around the top of your head.
Wow. And
so bird tweets are often very hard to localize for us. But birds, because they have smaller ears and smaller heads, can do it.
Well, they probably have a higher frequency range altogether anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. This also brings up a point that I wanted to make with you, which is I've always been fascinated by what are called binaural recordings,
uh-huh.
wherein you take a dummy head or even a real head, a person, and stick microphones in the ears, record music that way, and then play it back on headphones.
Yes, exactly. And it's quite effective in many cases, although it has a similar problem with the realizer. The more fine control you have on the frequency shaping, the more often that it doesn't fit, because everybody's ears is particular. And so there's this one of the problems is, as you make it more realistic, you also make it more realistic for a narrower group of people, and then realistic for others. Yeah, so it's very difficult. Military pilots have their head-related transfer function measured in an anechoic chamber, and then they have a little chunk of code that has this head-related transfer function. And when they're in the airplane, when they hear from their wingman, it comes from the direction that the wingman is. And when they hear from ground control, it comes from below them. When they hear threat warnings, it projects them from the direction that they're listening to, and it does track their head movements. And so pilots' situational awareness is dramatically improved by being able to place the sounds that are the cues for their situational awareness in different places.
That's amazing. We've already
Isn't
got some
it?
Questions in the chat room. Web7436 asks, recommendations on earbuds?
Earbuds. Well... Earbuds or
ear
monitors
than we might think at first, but go ahead.
So these are custom in-ear monitors. We have to make the distinction. My chair is sitting on it. The cable. I'll get another.
Yeah, we have to make the distinction between custom molded in-ear monitors.
Well, these are custom molded in-ear monitors.
Right, and they were molded from your own ears, right?
Yep, and these are regular in-ear monitors. Okay, and then there's earbuds, which is like the ones that rest in your ear concha. Mm-hmm. Okay, so like the Apple iPod, the thing that it comes with that doesn't go in your ear canal, that's an earbud. The best earbud is the UNPK1. Costs $150 maybe. It's a lot of money for an earbud, but oh my gosh, they are incredibly good sounding. They're as good sounding as a regular $200 headphone.
Who makes them?
UNPK1.
Ah, okay. Good. Well, there you go. There's a recommendation right there. Now, earbuds, I have to say that if you have the money to get custom molded in-ear monitors, that's probably the best solution, right?
You know, sometimes it's hard to get good isolation with the custom molds. I mean, sometimes you have to really make sure you get it right when you get the mold done. Make sure there's a bite block that you don't close your jaw because it changes the ear canal. Make sure you're not leaning down reading a magazine when you get it because it changes the shape of your ear canal.
So by the way, we should mention to everybody that this process, you go to an audiologist.
You go to an audiologist.
The audiologist squirts some goo in your ear, and you have to sit there and let it harden for a few minutes.
Right.
And then they pull it out, and they send it to the lab, and they form a set of custom-molded pieces, plastic there, and then you put the drivers inside of that, and wires come off it, and so on. But as you're saying, you have to make sure that your mouth is in the right place. There you can see a little picture of it. And you have to make sure, as you say, you're not looking down. It's a little bit of a drag, but the end result, I find, at least for my custom molded earplugs, which are not monitors, they're just noise reducers.
Mm-hmm.
But that makes such a difference over a generic, any kind of generic earplugs.
There's some tips. The Edemotic has a small three-flange tip that goes deep in the ear canal that seals really, really well, but it's somewhat uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And the spongy tips sure has a spongy tip that's rounded shape, and it fits very well in the ear and provides really good isolation. Those two generally, I find, provide better isolation than the custom molded in-ear monitors. But the custom molded ones are, I mean, it comes close, don't get me wrong, and if you've gotten a good impression, it should be essentially the same. But the foam ones do just really probably better isolation in the long run.
I'm actually amazed at that, because there'd have to be some gaps between the foam and the actual walls of the ear canal where it is, allowing sound to get through more so than a custom mold. I'm amazed to hear you say that generics can be better, can be as good and even better than custom molds.
Well, you have to remember that your ear canal changes shape. So if you're chewing or talking or moving your head around, leaning your head up and down, your ear canal changes shape.
Right.
And the custom molded ones typically are relatively hard plastic. Sensophonics makes a soft silicon mold.
That's actually the company that made my ear plugs with Sensophonics.
Right, and the silicon molds do a little bit better. Oftentimes, they'll actually increase the size of the mold very slightly from what the actual casting was, so that it does fit a little bit more tightly. But the problem is that your ear changes shape a little bit, and the custom molds don't change shape as easily as the foam ones. Yeah,
that's a good point. Now, I've got a bunch of comments in the chat room from people who are saying, "Yeah, but these in-ear monitors and earbuds and so on—they hurt. They hurt their ears."
Yeah, they certainly can. The Edemotic triple flanges can be really painful sometimes. The Edemotic has a new triple flange. It's not new really anymore. It's been around a couple of years, but they don't come stock with the normal Edemotics, and it's much small. It's significantly smaller in size and is more comfortable. But it's true that a lot of the in-ears are quite uncomfortable.
So
or can be.
They can be for some people, certainly.
Yeah, so it pays to take your time, try all the tips that come with them. Sometimes there are, you know, you can interchange the tips and find one on one manufacturer. That one of the guys at Headroom, for example, with Sennheiser, has a double flange tip that he really likes, and he tries to put it on all his headphones that he's using. So it's a little tricky to find the right one. I find that the foam ones are the ones that provide the best isolation and are most comfortable in the long run, but are the hardest to put in because they kind of flop around when you put them in.
Yeah. Tom Terrific in the chat room mentions, and I was going to mention this too, that Leo Laporte at I think at CES had a sort of a semi-custom fit a pair of in-ear monitors made, where I think they stuck a little balloon in his ear and blew up the balloon, and that kind of took the shape and ended up making molds from that, or maybe that was just the earpiece itself. I don't remember the specifics. Do you remember anything, know anything about a company that does sort of semi-custom where you don't actually have to go to an audiologist?
There are a couple out there. I think there's some motorcycling ones that are like that. But there are a couple out there. I don't remember the names, though.
Yeah. So that leads, the whole problem of if an in-ear monitor is painful for you, then obviously you need to go with an on-ear or over-the-ear. Now, what I'm wearing right now is what we call circumaural, which is around the ear. It's what those old Kosses were that we used that actually, you know, have a pad and cover over the entire ear, as opposed to the smaller ones that sit on the ear. Any thoughts about those two styles?
Well, full-size headphones are generally more comfortable. Full-size headphones, as a general rule, sound better. Because you don't have to try to enclose the driver in such a small enclosure. Of course, the problem is that you've got a little speaker inside a tiny enclosure. And sealed headphones is even worse. I mean, there's open-back headphones and sealed headphones. Mm-hmm. Sealed headphones can provide some isolation from outside noise. Open-back headphones don't provide isolation from outside noise. But open-back headphones let the driver do what it wants to do without feeling any back pressure from the enclosure resonances. So open headphones, open full-size headphones generally sound better than closed full-size headphones, and larger headphones are generally more comfortable and generally sound better than smaller headphones. But it's not always the case. Yeah. In fact, today, I put up a review on the Beyerdynamic DT1350, which is a small headphone. I'm afraid I don't have it in the room right now, but it's a small headphone that is super oral on the ear, very small, and it is sealing, and it sounds absolutely terrific. It's about a $300 headphone, a fabulous, fabulous headphone.
Wow.
And provides almost as much isolation as an in-ear monitor. The in-ear monitors provide the most isolation. Then there's some sealed headphones that provide a lot of isolation, like these Beyer DT1350s, and the old Beyer DT48 provides a lot of isolation. Shure SRH 840 provides a good amount of isolation. So some of them provide a lot. Some of them don't provide a lot. The Denon sealed headphones are, you know, it's, I don't even know why they bother calling them sealed, because they don't isolate hardly at all. Mm-hmm. So, and then noise canceling headphones provide probably more isolation as a rule than regular sealed headphones, but they don't provide as much isolation as in-ear monitors if they're sealed properly.
Right. Now, I have to say, you and I both agreed that the Bose Quiet Comfort 15s are probably the best active noise canceling headphones on the market, certainly what I use.
Absolutely. You know, you sort of hate to give kudos to Bose sometimes, but in this particular case, the Quiet Comfort 15 is awesome. The Quiet Comfort 3 is not.
Yeah.
The Sony makes a decent noise canceler, and Sennheiser makes a decent noise canceler, but Bose got it right, man. They really did. They're very, very good.
I agree with you. It's not so easy to praise Bose audio products generally for their quality, but these Quiet Comfort 15s are awesome.
Awesome. Awesome. But I'll say again, though, that the in-ear monitors provide more isolation, and there's one called the Jerry Harvey 13, JH13, that is absolutely fabulous sounding. And when it comes to sound quality, the in-ear monitors just blow away the noise cancelers, because the noise cancelers have all that extra circuitry and extra signal going through the system. So
understood. Eric Duckman in the chat room asks, have you seen or heard the Sculpted Ears?
No.
You haven't heard that company? Okay, sculptedears.com, and ears is spelled E-E-R-S, according to this posting on the chat room.
You know, that's the problem with headphones. There are a jillion of them.
Well, we'll take a look at that. Maybe you'll cover that on your site. Speaking of which, I wanted to touch upon your new site, which is part of my family now of websites, innerfidelity.com. I want to make sure everyone goes checks that out, because you are reviewing, as you say, a jillion headphones.
Yeah.
And there it is, right there, innerfidelity.com, a proud member of the Source Interlink Media family of websites.
Yeah, I got to tell you something funny, Scott. I live out here in the wilds of Montana, in Bozeman, Montana, and it's a funny thing. I work at my house. I have a farther commute to my coffee cup than I do my headphone testing system. And now that I'm in with Source Interlink, which is, as you know, is a big company, Motor Trend and Sail Magazine and Motorcyclist, all these big magazines, right? And I'm in the home technology group like you are.
Yep.
And we get on these mailing lists. And so sometimes I open my mail in the morning. I'm sitting out in the back porch looking at snow. And there's a thing. There was one the other day. It said, I found an extra candy bar in the candy machine on the fifth floor. Does anybody, you know, was it anybody's? And, of course, I emailed right away. Yes, please send it to 416.
So, that's hilarious.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be on board at Source Interlink. InnerFidelity is a site that's dedicated to personal audio.
Just headphones, mostly headphones at this point.
Yeah, but I have to tell you, I'm not exactly sure what the scope is, because I really do have to focus on getting a lot of headphones reviewed, and there are so many of them. But for sure, if you can carry it normally around with you, like to take an extreme example, the little speakers that you can bring to your hotel room with you, I would characterize that as personal audio.
Sure.
So bottom line, if you can carry it, if you carry it in normal use, it will be part of InnerFidelity's site. Now, so it's headphones, headphone amplifiers, portable media players, and then there's the potential of some iPod apps and iPad apps and things like that. Computer audio is a possibility, but that's such a large category.
That's a huge field in and of itself. And in fact,
in and of itself,
next week we're going to have on Chris Conacher from computeraudiophile.com
sure.
to talk about that exact subject.
Yeah.
He was supposed to be on last week, but we got preempted by Leo Laporte himself, and can't say no to the boss.
No.
So I wanted to ask you, I'm fascinated by how you go about testing headphones. I mean, obviously, you put them on, you listen to them, but you also measure them. And I wanted to give everybody a little sense of that process. And I know you can actually show us where
sure.
in your studio you actually do the measurements of headphones. Let's take a look.
Right. Well, first of all, I have to say that this isn't a studio. It's a laboratory.
Laboratory. Okay. All right.
All right. I'm a geek. I got to make these fine distinctions.
Of course. I'm totally hip.
I'm going to move the camera around, so there may be some jerking and herky jerking here a little bit. So this is my lab, and over there, that is the head that I test headphones on. That's a Head Acoustics. Head Acoustics is the name of the company, and that's about a $20,000 head that mimics.
God.
Yeah, it mimics the exact characteristics of the human ear. It's got a soft ear, as you can see. It's got a calibrated ear canal, and
that's still modeled after some person's ear, right?
It's modeled after everybody's ear.
It's like an average.
Yeah, and it's an IEC specified shape. The actual shape of that ear is in the specification of the IEC spec for measuring headphones.
Gotcha.
And then this is the testing chamber. So when I close the door, I get about 15 dB of isolation. It's sitting on wheelbarrow inner tubes. Then this is the preamp for the head, for the microphones in the head. This is an audio precision System 2 Cascade tester. It's the thing that does all the analysis. And then, you know, a computer and whatnot. Some folks may be familiar here with my desk where I do all my little YouTube videos. And I got a whole little laboratory here.
A little laboratory, and we'll call it a laboratory. I'm absolutely perfectly happy with that. Well, that's great. And so you actually take the time not only to listen subjectively, but to find out objectively what's going on with any given set of headphones.
Absolutely.
Now, that brings me to one question that I've always had, and I know we talked a little bit about this offline, but I wanted to make sure to cover it here, which is, how the heck can headphones, which have these tiny little drivers, typically, generate good bass, you know, down into the, I mean, are you getting frequency responses down into the 30 or 20 hertz region?
This headphone right here is basically flat to about 10 hertz. This is the Odyssey LCD2. This is a planar magnetic driver, and this is what one of the drivers look like. And
look at that.
This is a large mylar surface, and then there are bar magnets through here that basically oppose each other and create a really strong magnetic field where the diaphragm is. And on the surface of the diaphragm are the conductive traces. And so as you put current through it, the magnet wiggles it. So it's sort of like an electrostatic diaphragm, only moved with magnetic force.
Right.
And it's got frequency response that's fairly flat to 10 hertz.
Wow. Is that what you want in a headphone, is flat frequency response? F-Loop in the chat room asks, how close is the correlation between measurements and subjective sound quality? Does each headphone type, like in-ear, circumoral, etc., have an ideal frequency response shape, or should they all really be flat, ideally?
Oh, this is such a complicated question. You can do a whole show on it. We talked a little bit about the gain that occurs on your ridges of your ear and your body, and there's also changes in gain due to the ear canal and so on and so forth. So by the time the sound gets to the eardrum, it is no longer the same shape. I mean, I've got some measurements. I've been printing out measurements from a variety of things. And here, this is a typical frequency response curve on the top here.
Uh-huh.
And you do want it to be flat. Here's the bass side, and you can see it rolls off. And that's due to the fact that it really can't contain within that headphone the low frequencies. And so it loses low frequencies at some point.
Now, which model is that?
Oh, this is a Pioneer HDJ-2000, a Pioneer headphone. Actually, a pretty good-sounding headphone. So that's not a bad frequency response right there. Mm-hmm. And so what I actually do is I measure it five times in five slightly different positions, and then I average or put all those measurements together and divide by five. Okay, so that gives a spatially average, because as the headphone moves, the resonances of the chamber and the high frequencies shift around a little bit. You add it together, and then you get also subtract that HRTF, that head-related transfer function that I was talking about, that has all these gains in it to try to make it flat. But the bottom line is that there's no real way of knowing what flat is. Scientists engineers have been, yabbering about that, whether it's diffuse field equalized or free field equalized, or there's all sorts of methods. I think Thiel just recently started proposing other ways of measuring the headphones, and a few years ago. So it's hard to know where flat is. But bottom line, at least in the from 1,000 hertz down or so, or maybe 2,000 hertz down, you want it to be flat. And above that, you want it to maybe roll off a little bit, and then you'll also see, just as a natural occurrence due to the resonances and whatnot, a lot of spiky up and downness. And that's not coming from the driver. That's coming from resonant cancellation so on and so forth. So it's hard to know. Now, the question of, is there a relationship between what you hear subjectively and what you hear on what you see on the graphs? I would say that the answer is yes. I would say it's probably more than with speakers and with electronics, and here's why. Electronics are so good these days, for the most part, that the distortions and artifacts that are imperfect in their measurements are very low in amplitude and are difficult to hear. And so the relationship between the nature of those artifacts and what they sound like is difficult because it's so small to start with. And then with speakers, you have a room in between you and the speaker. So you could measure a speaker in an anechoic chamber, or, you know, using a gated signal, and you could measure a speaker. But then when you really put it in a room, how much is room, how much is speaker, and reflections, and so on and so forth. So with speakers, it's hard to tell the difference. But with headphones, it's directly coupled. The other important part is that there are a lot of crappy headphones out there. So there's a wide variance of how good the measurements are. And so it's pretty easy to tell a good headphone from a bad headphone, or, you know, a really well-performing headphone from a not-so-well-performing headphone. Mm-hmm. It's quite easy. In fact, I saw a poorly performing headphone in this pile right here. Here you go. So that's the frequency response. Right there, you can see it's wobbling up and
jumping
down
all over the place.
Yeah. Okay, that's a United Airlines Flight 192 $2 headphone that I measured.
You actually grab the headphones from airline flights and test those too. That's hilarious.
I'm a geek. What can I tell you? Yeah.
Hey, I'm totally with you, man. I measure sound levels on airplanes all the time, just to see whether or not, you know, how loud the sound levels are on the airplane. I've done that for years.
I'll give you an exclusive, Scott. I think I'll be publishing the article tomorrow, and people can read it. But here's the amazing thing.
Yeah.
They measured horribly. The distortion was on the order of, it was above 10%. It was 100% distortion up to about 100 hertz. And then it didn't go below 10% until you got to 1,000 hertz. Okay, so these are horribly distorted headphones. Horribly distorted. So you wonder how they could sound any good at all, you know, and of course they really don't. But you know what else I found out was that one ear was out of polarity from the other ear.
What?
Yeah. And then when I listened to them, I went, well, you know, they don't sound as bad as they measure. And the reason why is because you get this huge, spacey, weird image, and I think they do it intentionally so that it grabs your attention on an airplane, because they can isolate it out. They can spend, you know, 30 cents manufacturing this headphone. They know it's going to sound like crap, you know. And so they wire one earpiece out of phase to make it sound big and grab your attention on an airplane so you can follow along, I think.
Wow.
I'm going to follow up on it. I'll call the airlines and dig my way through the phone system or something and try to find one of the engineers that specifies headphones. But I think they do it on purpose.
Good luck with that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the alternative is that, you know, next time you get on a flight, get the headphones and send them to me, you know, and I'll measure them again, so.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah.
Hey, before we continue, I want to just take a moment here to thank our sponsor for this episode, Netflix, which delivers movies directly to your home by streaming and saves you time, money, and a ton of hassles. You can instantly watch thousands of TV episodes and movies streamed directly to your PC or Mac or your TV or other Netflix-enabled device, which might include a game console or a Blu-ray player. It's just about everywhere. You can watch as many movies as you want, anytime you want. There are never any late fees or due dates. Be sure to sign up for your free trial at netflix.com/twit. And we thank Netflix for their support of the Twit Network. So, Tile, let's see. Oh, you know, one thing I wanted to make sure we talked about was levels. And you must measure, like, the maximum amount, the maximum sound pressure level that each of these headphones can produce, right?
I don't. I measure them at 100 dB.
Which is pretty loud.
Right. I measure them. All the measurements are made at 90 dB. But the one harmonic distortion measurement is done at 100 dB to kind of stress it out. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go higher than that. I don't want to blow up headphones, you know.
Right. Well, yeah. I want to make a point of this because it's a particular crusade of mine and has been for many years. because I think I'm concerned, particularly that the younger folks are listening to these iPods and so on, these earbuds, at very high levels, and they are causing damage to their hearing, which may not become apparent right away. It sometimes takes a while, but you end up with tinnitus, which is ringing in the ears. you mess up the frequency response of what you're hearing, and this is really not a good thing. I do want to point out, I want to mention one thing here before I get your response to that. There's a website that I would like everyone to check out, which is called listentoyourbuds.com. Which is a website dedicated to helping to try to prevent hearing damage from listening to too loud sound on these headphones. And the sponsors include the CEA, the Consumer Electronics Association, which puts on CES every year, the Recording Industry Association of America. There it is, listentoyourbuds.com. The RIAA, the Music Teachers National Association, and the Music Educators National Conference. I just want to make sure that everybody understands that it's possible to do some serious damage when listening on headphones. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. 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 You can damage your hearing.
I'm sorry, that's listentoyourbuds.org. Someone, Android Bruce in the chat room, pointed that out, and I thank him for that. Sorry, go ahead, Tile. Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. You can really wreck your hearing by listening to headphones too loud. I've got no easy method, although I'm trying to work on a couple of ideas using an iPod or an iPhone to measure how loud your headphones are. There are some SPL level meter apps, and I'm going to try playing around with how you can accurately measure your headphone loudness level. But, people very often turn their headphones up too loud, and it really does mess with your hearing. You can get tinnitus and all sorts of stuff, and it's not good, man. It really is painful. The tricky thing is to get people to stop doing it. And yes. How do you do that? All right? And here's my answer to that. It's not about hearing safety. It's about how much money you spend on your gear and getting your money out of it. And the truth is that once you turn up the sound past a certain point, it will sound worse. And here's why. You have a thing called the acoustic reflex or stapedius reflex. And what it does is it tenses the stapedius muscle and the tensor tympani muscle inside your ear, pulls the bones away from where they belong and stiffens them up, and it prevents it attenuates sound getting from your eardrum to the oval window of the cochlea.
And this is a protective reflex, right?
Absolutely. In fact, every time you vocalize, it tends to go off to mute the sound of your own voice. It's a reflex. It's an involuntary reflex. So when you hear a loud sound, this reflex goes off and it clamps down the bones in your ear. And it can reduce the low frequencies by as much as 20 dB, okay? But it doesn't reduce the sound almost at all over 2 kilohertz. And so there's a line in between those two. And so when the stapedius reflex kicks in, you lose bass response. And also, because they're muscles, they have a little twitchiness to them. And so when it fires, you get noise. And it's about 50 dB, 55 dB of noise. So your signal-to-noise ratio goes down. And so the level that the stapedius reflex kicks in is often quoted as 90 dB, but that's for single tones. For broadband noise, it's about 75 dB, which is not too loud.
No.
It's loud, but it's not really loud. So as a consequence, when you listen on headphones or you listen to your speaker system and you turn it up to the point where your stapedius reflex starts kicking in, you are destroying the sound quality of your system. And if you listen carefully, and I have, just try to see that this is true, it will change the tonal character of the sound. I play Pink Noise and get my stapedius reflex to go off because I can do it voluntarily. If you know how to do it, it makes this kind of rushing sound in your ears. But and I talked to Mead Killian, the president of Etymotic, who has you know, patents and papers about hearing aid research. They're big here. They make in-ear headphones, but they also make a lot of hearing aid type products and hearing research products.
Right.
And he agrees 100%. He says, absolutely. Now, the funny thing is there aren't a lot of papers published on this, but of changing the sound quality. Most of the papers published are about diagnosing illness by looking at the stapedius reflex in your ears, and they can do all sorts of numerical calculations and tell the volume of your middle ear and whether there's fluid in it and even whether parts of your brain are working by pinging noise and changing pressure against your ear canal and stuff.
Right.
So bottom line, if you listen to music loud, you're not only going to hurt yourself, you're throwing away the money you spent on your gear.
by not hearing the best possible sound.
Right. So generally speaking,
you're
exactly
right. You're exactly right. That's the way to sell it. Not that you're hurting yourself, because youngsters don't believe they ever hurt themselves.
Yeah.
But you're not getting your money's worth.
Exactly.
I like it.
Well, most of the youngsters aren't getting their money's worth anyway because they're listening to earbuds and highly compressed music. But we'll save that for another day.
I do hope you'll come back because there's plenty more to talk about.
Sure.
One thing I wanted to touch on before we're done here, we got another few minutes, so we're not quite done yet. But and that is the whole concept of breaking in headphones. Now, we've heard a lot of talk for over many years from audiophiles about breaking in speakers, breaking in electronics, even breaking in TVs, in particular plasmas. Is the same thing true of headphones?
Well, I'm running some series of articles right now. I've done a second round of tests. I've actually stumbled across a mathematician who's helping me out and looking at my spreadsheets. But we've done some measurements on the AKG Q701, which is the AKG Quincy Jones headphone, but it was also the K701. It's been around a long time and is known or thought of widely in the headphone community as a headphone that needs a lot of break-in, and I've experienced that myself with them where I thought that they didn't sound right out of the box and it took them a while to break in. And so we did one test where we measured over like 100 hours and intermittently, and then we did it again where I measured it for 100 hours every hour, and then I measured that same headphone subsequently from hour 100 to 200. And it does look like there is an artifact in the measurements that could be attributable to break-in.
In other words, the measurement at the beginning is different than the measurement after 100 or 200 hours.
Essentially, yes. Although it's funny, it actually kicks in at about 20 hours and then goes away at about 70 hours.
Really?
And it may be because the plastic and the diaphragms are made of two different kinds of plastic, or I don't know. Who knows? But there's something happening, it looks like.
Okay.
But the thing that's important to mention is the amplitude of these differences are on the order of half a dB or so. And we can also see in the same sets of measurements fluctuations over time that are probably due to the differences in temperature of day and night. When we first did the measurement, we saw some things happening right at the beginning of the measurements, and it could be just because the ear pads were settling in. So we're talking about differences that are very, very small. And I could easily buy the argument that, yes, we can measure a break-in effect, but it's probably inaudible. Mm. So the next question that you have to approach is, what is the level of audibility of various things, and we'll get around to that. But bottom line, it does look like there's an effect from break-in. However, I have to say it's very small, and it's happening on the headphone that's really well known to it. Generally speaking, I would say you pull a headphone out of the box, you listen to it, that's what it's going to sound like. Now, I'll tell you what does break in a lot, and that's your head. Your acoustic memory, it's almost not fair to call it your acoustic memory. It's more that your head is a fuzzy filter, and it uses sounds. You've heard of the cocktail party effect, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I think, am I correct that you have a lot of conversations going on all around you, But you are able to zoom in on one particular conversation and filter out the rest, consciously speaking.
Yes, even though the noise is at a higher level than the voice you're listening to, you can listen to that other voice in the noise. And that's a process that occurs in the brain, essentially, of acclimating yourself to it. And what happens when you put any headphone on or a speaker system or something, put a headphone on, your brain will acclimate to its sound. At Headroom, we had the problem, and not as much anymore, but we had the problem at one time a lot where enthusiasts only had one pair of headphones. They got another pair of headphones that we said would be better, and they got them out of the box, they put them on, and then they'd call us, and they'd go, these headphones don't sound nearly as good as my other headphones. And we would say, okay, just wait, you have a 30-day satisfaction guarantee, don't listen to your other headphones, just listen to those headphones, and then after a couple of weeks, go back and try it. And they would do that, and then they go, oh yeah, my headphones are horrible. So the thing that breaks in is...
an acclimation effect.
Yeah, the thing that breaks in is your head.
It gets used to this new sound.
Not only that, it attempts to make it sound like what you think it should sound like.
Hmm. So we're and that's going to be hard to measure, isn't it?
You're not going to be able to measure that.
Let's stick some electrodes in the brain and see what happens.
Yeah, you're talking about a whole other group of people that do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right. What about simulating surround in headphones? We touched briefly. We mentioned the Smith Realizer,
which
is a system that does this. It actually, you know, headphones are basically two channels. That's all you got. Now, there are some gaming headphones that actually have multiple channels, multiple drivers, but these are big, giant things that you wear when you're playing games. But for listening to music or movies, typically you've got a two-channel headphone, so you need to be able to simulate the effect of a surround system. How effective are those, in your opinion?
Generally speaking, it falls into that category that I talked about before. The closer you get to an accurate head-related transfer function, the more individually specific it becomes. And so the question is, how do you get something that shoots down the middle? I will have to say that I do think the Dolby headphone HRTFs are pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Dolby headphone is just for people to understand. Dolby headphone is a function found in many AV receivers that simulate surround using an averaged head-related transfer function. And I've heard it too, and I've thought it was reasonably good.
The only thing I don't like about it is they add in the room reverb. And when you change the size of the rooms, you can tell that they not only put in head-related transfer function information, but they put in artificial walls. And the problem that I have with that is that your visual system will know how big the room is and know what it sounds like, and then the artificial one creates some cognitive dissonance. But I think in the end, it kind of goes away. And I mean, as we say, you can acclimate and you get used to it and fairly quickly. And at any rate, Dolby headphone, I think, is pretty good. There have been a number of these processors over the years. Sennheiser had a thing called the Lucas for a while, and there's just an assortment of them here and there. I've not thought that any of them were any better than a simple crossfeed, because they tend to add junk to the... Mm. I mean, it's a lot of processing, so it ends up doing some stuff to destroy the signal. And I like the crossfeed circuit because just it's an analog delay. You know, there's no digitizing or anything like that going on. Sure. However, I do think the Dolby headphone is good. And the Smith Realizer, with it, you actually do calibrate your ears. I'm not sure exactly how it's done. I haven't done it yet. But you actually do a process of calibrating your own ears. And so it can be more specific to you. When I heard their generic version, I thought it was quite good. And then I have known a number of people who've done it. Calman Rubinson, for example, did the review in Stereophile, and he hates headphones. And he said, I'd listen to these any day. And you know, he's got good ears. So, yeah, it's a very good process. So I think Dolby headphone is decent. The headphones that do it acoustically, I think that's malarkey. And the reason why is that when you put a headphone on, it's a coupler. Sound isn't propagating through space anymore. It's being acoustically coupled, and it acts much more like a resonant circuit in an electrical circuit. So there's acoustic resonances and impedances and so on and so forth. So it's a coupler. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, it's very hard in a headphone to get directionality of sound. Most of it is essentially non-directional. It's being fluid coupled, essentially, into the ear. Mm-hmm. So I don't like the idea of multiple speakers in a headphone, because they're really doing mostly exciting the chamber from different angles as opposed to projecting sound at your ear at different angles.
I
haven't heard one that's convincing at all, and generally speaking, I think the theory is sort of flawed, that really what you want to do is do it electronically and then try to couple to the ear accurately.
Mm-hmm. Caffeine-free Dave in the chat room says he's using a pair of Grado SR60i. What do you think of those?
At one point, I thought the Grado SR60 was one of the best headphones in the world, because it really is, price performance wise, it's fabulous. A lot of the headphone geeks will know that I pretty much don't like Grado headphones. They're too bright for me, and they're measurably bright, and I really don't like them for the most part. But the 60s is one of the exceptions because they do so well. However, there's another headphone now, the Sennheiser PX100. This is a Sennheiser PX200, but the Sennheiser PX100 is a lot like this. It's an open headphone. The PX100 Mark II i is, I think, a much superior sounding headphone than to the Grado SR60, although the Grado SR60 is still a very good sounding headphone. And the cool thing about these headphones is they fold up like a pair of sunglasses. And they're very, very small. You can put them in your pocket. And mm-hmm. they sound very, very good, both the 100 and the 200. The 100's open, the 200's closed.
Android Bruce asks, what about the Sennheiser HD 555?
Yeah, I think...
Okay. Well, listen, with that, we've come to the end of our hour, and what a fascinating conversation it's been.
Can I do a real quick one?
Yeah, sure.
Audacy LCD2 is probably the world's best sounding headphone. Sennheiser HD800, probably the world's most accurate headphone. Recording professionals will really love these.
And how much are those?
They're $1,200 or something, and the Audacys are $900.
Okay, so those ain't cheap.
No.
But if you want the best... you want to listen to Tile about those, for sure. And you want to go to his website, innerfidelity.com, where you will find just a ton of stuff about headphones and everything we've been talking about. Tile, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure being here with you. And hi, all you headphone geeks out there.
Yeah, all you headphone geeks, be sure to go to innerfidelity.com. My online homes, of course, are ultimateavmag.com and hometheater.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Chris Conacher, who got delayed from last week, so he's coming on next week. He's going to be talking about computer audio and his website, computeraudiophile.com. So all sorts of stuff about file formats and USB DACs and all that kind of great stuff. So sure hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out.